Welcome to We're Not Wizards. We are the best, but not wizards. Enjoy the show!
Post-it note and dice with stickers on it where you've written on the kind of the things on it. This would be, in your case, it would be the cut up bits of kind of old wallpaper.
I see where you're going.
It would be the list of all the shark movies that you've ever watched. It would be, you know, who is your favorite kind of, what's your favorite kind of Roald Dahl book? I mean, it would be kind of, I guess, you know, so there we go. It'd be everything. Ever, essentially.
Why do you bring up Roald Dahl? Is he a favorite of yours, or was he? Because he was a huge favorite of mine when I was a boy.
The thing with Roald Dahl is what always interests me. Apart from, and you find out terrible things about that terrible people once they've passed away, and it turns out that Roald Dahl was a huge kind of. He wasn't the nicest person in the world,
not in the least.
But he had. And we're just going to let this run, and then we can kind of wing it back in to do like an intro. I'm with Nathan Thornton. Wald is he's a kind of a wallpaper designer. He likes nostalgia. You might have known him from that that old wallpaper. He's definitely not a large or an extra large. I'd say he's a bit of a medium. Potentially, you could say that being a vegan, he always hopes that the green team wins. So we're going to talk about...
I love this. This is almost everything I've ever done. This is like my whole biography, right?
The thing with Roald Dahl, and the thing that you discover about Roald Dahl, is that Roald Dahl had his hit with Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Mm-hmm. And everybody went crazy for the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. But he wanted to be like a kind of a horror author. He was wanting to be somebody who wrote kind of thrillers and really, really kind of dark, twisted stuff. And when his book publisher said to him, no, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was such a huge success. They wanted him to continue to write kind of children's books in that kind of vein. So he went, okay. And as a kind of a test, he then wrote things like, he wrote like George's Marvelous Medicine and The Twits, and he wrote the 18th, as I think it's the 18th, The Emergency, really. But they all had really rather grotesque and horrible things in it. So like The Twits literally had a scene where the twits kind of pour lime on branches so that birds land on them and then get stuck in the lime. And then Mrs. Twit, he used to come along with a set of kind of scissors or secateurs and kind of cut the birds from the trees where they were stuck. It's really, really kind of dark, really, really kind of dark stuff.
Nasty stuff, for sure.
But he's also known for, across over here, I don't think he ever got it in the States, he's also known for something called Tales of the Unexpected, it's very, very interesting because it's literally a lot of them were kind of tales that he was kind of wrote or were involved in. They were kind of short stories, usually didn't last that long, and it almost became like a badge of honor if you were like a celebrity that was involved in one of his kind of, if you wrote to be part of the story. So that's kind of role, you know, kind of Roald Dahl kind of thing. Hello, welcome to the show. Welcome to We're Not Wizards. My name's Richard. I'll be your host. As I say, joining me, I've got the wonderful, fantastic, amazing, he's a medium. It's Nathan Thornton. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Richard. I couldn't tell if you were welcoming me or if you were welcoming the listeners. Everybody, and I suspect it was the listeners, so I felt welcomed.
It's everybody. And welcome one, welcome all. As I say, appears I might be late with this, but I'm never late. I know exactly. I arrive precisely when it expected. I'm not saying I'm a wizard, but I might be. When we first kind of communicated on email, well, it was maybe even direct message through one of the social media channels. You were about to go to Gen Con and you were looking at kind of launching kind of everything ever. So I guess to touch on that, first of all, was we will circle back onto other things. How was Gen Con? How did that go for you?
Gen Con was lovely. Yes, I reached out to you, I think, on social media because you had written, I think, a complimentary review of my game, That'll Wallpaper.
Yes.
And I wanted to reach out to you to say thank you because I really enjoyed reading it. Because I think you had written something and then you did a podcast, an audio review of it later. So,
yes.
And I liked that. And you were like, would you like to come on my podcast? I'm like, I would love to. I do have a new game coming out. And it was launching at Gen Con. But yeah, Gen Con was fantastic. I've gone about every year that it's been held since 2019.
Wow.
And it's wild. It's large. It's busy. It's packed. I mean, you saw the pictures. It's gross. It's full. But, you know, it's interesting because I do feel like I'm at a point in my own whatever, I guess, like growth as a board game designer. It's really nice. Because my first couple times that I went to Gen Con, I felt like so, like I had to hustle and just like be like, you know, pestering publishers and like pitching and like really chasing people down, trying to be like, pay attention to me. But it's kind of nice to go and to have a couple of games that are out there that, you know, people know to the extent that they know, but to feel less of that, like, kind of hunger that, like, hey, pay attention to me. I mean, I certainly did some pitches for some games. I talked to some publishers that I hadn't talked to before, some that I had. But it's really nice to like have board game friends, to like to have people that you only see at board game conventions and then never again, and play games with them and see things. So yeah, I feel like I was able to enjoy Gen Con as a participant who enjoys games, as a designer who has some games out there, and as like an aspiring designer who would like to have more games out there. So it was nice to kind of shift and experience it in all those different ways.
Did you queue up for 3.5 days and get your Disney lore canon? Oh, nonsense?
I got in line and the line was about 4.5 hours.
Wow.
And I was second to next, and I realized that I didn't want to wait any longer. So I got out of line and I got in line for Sky Team. No, I never waited in line. It's I wasn't even sure. Well, because I saw the line every time I walked by. And I was like, what is this the line for? And I hadn't even heard, were people talking about Disney Lorcana before Gen Con? I don't think I heard any buzz about it.
I think everybody's a bit tentative about it because people are worried about going in full commitment and going, yeah, this is amazing. This is going to be fantastic. I think there's always a bit of, Disney sells the license to allow games to get created, and some of the games are obviously very, very good, and some of the games could be kind of better. And I think that we've been a little bit spoiled with some of the games that we've had kind of recently. Mm-hmm. So in terms of like, say, the Villainous series of games, I mean, they were a lot more complicated than I thought they ever needed to be. But even then, on the same time, when I played, I got the chance to kind of play and write some stuff about Disney Animated. And I won't go into that because it's appearing in a publication soon.
Nice.
But that was, again, it was kind of like it was Funko Games. And I've been kind of waxing too much sugar about Funko Games recently with what they're kind of bringing to the hobby. So I think, as I said, I think in terms of Lorcana, some people are saying, right, is it just a kind of a trading card game that somebody slapped a couple of Disney characters on, and is it going to be another Keyforge, or is it going to be, because people are going to be saying, well, it's very, very similar to kind of Magic the Gathering.
Sure.
What I am, I guess one of the things that kind of I don't, and I guess it's within the rights of the Disney marketing team, is for them to come into a place like Gen Con, and I don't know if I would have been too happy if I was an exhibitor that they came in and potentially stole a lot of thunder. Because to me, somebody queuing for 12 hours to pick up a pack that quite literally is going to be available within 2 weeks.
Right. And it'll be available everywhere.
Yeah, let's face it, there's no way they're not going to launch this and it's going to be, you know, it's going to be sitting in Walmart and Target and places like mm-hmm. that. You know, they're going to make sure the distribution is kind of there. So I guess seeing somebody kind of like queuing for 12 hours to go and play something that's going to be available as opposed to coming and spending, you know, 2 hours with me and learning my game, which is never going to get the range of exposure. But that's just me. I'm old and cynical and kind of grumpy. In terms of your kind of history with board games themselves, let's go way back. Let's look at the line. The line is a dot. Okay. Were you, the more I speak to board gamers, I discover they seem to fall on two sides of the fence. They're either in the situation where they're very kind of creative and artistic and they fall into kind of board games that way, or alternatively, they're kind of very analytical and puzzle driven and mathematical and they fall into to kind of board games the other way. And so I guess my question for you is in terms of yourself, how did you kind of first discover the hobby yourself, I guess?
Do you mean, I feel like there's kind of two phases. There was like the games that I played as a child that I played with my brothers. I grew up with three brothers and in the, you know, in the 1980s and we played, I think, like the games that anybody else played. However, the more I think about it, I realized when I was a kid, we kind of had like the off-brand version of everything. because we didn't play like Yahtzee, but we played a game called Kismet. I don't know if you know this one. It's kind of like Yahtzee, except the die faces have different colors on them as well. So you could get a flush in addition to some of the other typical Yahtzee things. We played a lot of this game called Conspiracy, which was sort of like a move around the world, like Risk type of game, except it was like spies. And they had like these heads, these busts of heads that went around.
That rings a bell. It rings a bell. Yeah, yeah.
We didn't have Clue. We had a game called Whodunit, which was very, very close to Clue, but it wasn't Clue or Cluedo, as I think you guys call it.
It's like when you go into like over here, we have like the main brand kind of super, like, you know, again, like Walmart. Yeah. And you go in there and you'll get all your kind of, I'm pretty sure that most of the brands that are over either in the States, they're available in the UK now anyway. So I'd go in and buy a Hershey bar. But then you get supermarkets over here, which are called like, there's like, they're German, they're usually European based. So it's like Lidl and Aldi, but they have what you see, the off brand kind of Hershey bar, but it looks like a Hershey bar. It's got the coloring of a Hershey bar, but it's called, you know, the Kirschen bar or something. It's branded completely the same, but it's obviously meant to be kind of like the same kind of, you know, it's like the same kind of product, but it is slightly inferior in kind of taste, kind of thing. So I know what you mean when you're talking
about it. Yeah, but it's close enough. It's close enough. And then I think, like, if you are a family of six, which we were, and if your dad had a solidly middle class job where he worked for the city, you know, and if Kismet is like $4 cheaper than Yahtzee, then your sons are going to play Kismet. They're going to play Whodunit. They're going to play Conspiracy. Yeah. And we had a blast with games. Yeah.
Well, that's it. I mean, there's not like this snobbery, is there? I mean, it's not a case that kids would go, oh, you're playing Kismet and not Yahtzee. There's not that. I mean, it'd be a family thing. I don't remember. I remember playing a lot of games like Monopoly and stuff like that when I was growing up. I don't remember then going into school and having a discussion about playing Monopoly. It sounds strange, but I don't remember sitting around with my friends at school and saying, well, we had a cracking game in Monopoly and I managed to get Park Lane and Broad Street and blah, blah, blah.
Right, yeah.
I remember going into school and talking about the fact that we then spent kind of like 3 hours, me and my brother, playing Star Wars or Transformers or something along those lines, stuff that other kids potentially had that were kind of the popular stuff that was kind of like mainstream, or playing on like an Atari or you know, a spectrum in my kind of case. But I don't remember kind of discussing the kind of the board games. So with you,
that's interesting.
With you having brothers, were you with, was it three other brothers, did you say?
Yeah. There were four of us. I had two older brothers and one younger.
Wow. So you were, I feel sorry for your youngest brother then, because he must have got wailed on.
he did. Well, you know, it's funny because like I feel like my oldest brother wailed on my youngest brother and like skipped the two of us. But I feel like it was all in good fun. There was a lot of, I feel like that they really embraced wedgies for some reason. I don't know. I want to keep it PG, but I feel like that there was a lot of wedgies given by my oldest brother to my youngest brother, which at the time I would feel bad for my youngest brother, but at the same time I was glad it wasn't me.
It's definitely it's not me. And the other thing is as well, as I'm assuming, as like, you know, and this is something else that happened, is like, unless you were kind of like up to your eyeballs in money in the kind of the '80s, you would get, if you had an older brother, you would occasionally get kind of like their sweaters or, you know, their old clothes. I mean, it's like, here's your big brother's blazer that he was wearing to school kind of thing. And you get this huge thing that would never kind of fit you and stuff like that. So there was people that had like what we call hand-me-downs. That was a thing. People fixed kind of patches and jumpers and stuff like that and tears and stuff. And then it's like, well, your older brother had this and he wore it for like 4 years and now it's for you. And it's like, great, but I don't want his ice cream. But
we would always get hand-me-down bicycles. I don't think I had my own bicycle that was purchased for me until I was maybe a teenager. I would get my, I would get the trickle down once my brother got too big for his child's bike. It would become my bike because I was a child.
Yeah. What were you like at school? Were you an artistic child? Were you kind of like an academic child where you couldn't be bothered kind of child?
Well, I feel like I was definitely a big reader. So like I read a ton, and I would be the kid who would be sitting under a tree reading. I wasn't a big active or athletic child. I was an indoors kid, I guess, is what I think that I was. And I like to think of myself as smart. I remember, we would play, so it was the 80s, so Trivial Pursuit was really big. And I would, and my brothers hated this about me, but like I would read the questions in the Trivial Pursuit box just for the information that was on them. But then I would realize that like they were like, you're cheating at Trivial Pursuit. And I'm like, I can see that. I can see how that is an accurate accusation. But like I enjoyed feeling smart and I enjoyed like reading stuff and using that. So that's the kind of kid that I was. I wasn't a big artistic kid. I could never like draw or play a musical instrument or anything, but I like to read and I like to write.
Okay. So
how about you? What were you like? Were you like that?
I remember, and there's several points in your life where you remember when you first kind of did something. And I remember kind of drawing for the first time. And the reason I started drawing was because one of my brother's friend's older sisters, and she came around and we were just like, their mother was friends with our mother, so they were around having cups of tea in the other room, and we were obviously all forced to hang together, and it was like boring and dull. But then this girl was like, I can draw. And it's like, well, how do you draw? How do you learn to draw? She goes, we just go ahead and copy stuff. So that's how I started learning to draw. I was like mimicking how to kind of draw stuff. So I became quite artistic, I think. Because I was a bit of a reader. I wasn't very kind of sporty, but I was, I really, really kind of enjoyed the kind of the art side, the kind of the creative side. And it wasn't until after high school and well beyond that, that I discovered that I had a bit of, I had a voice about me. I think there's certain people that they get to a point where they go through kind of several kind of forms, not like a butterfly chrysalis type of thing. But I know that there's people that they kind of discover things about themselves that they kind of didn't realize. So as a very, very young kid, I expressed myself through my art. now as a crumbling old man. I express myself other. I still do the art. I do it very, very occasionally, but I find more challenge kind of expressing myself through the written world. And then on the other side of things is podcasting like this, because you don't plan. As I say, we don't plan it.
I noticed that.
There's no questions. Mm-hmm. And I've had people kind of went, I'm not sure about doing the show unless I know what we're going to talk about. And it's like, well, we're talking about you. And my view on this is, if I make you feel uncomfortable about having a conversation with me, then that's more on me than on the kind of the other side of it. So yeah, I think people find themselves, I think some people are lucky, and I think they find themselves a lot earlier in life, and then you get other people that they continually jump from thing to thing, and they eventually do find something that kind of brings them joy, brings them happiness or contentment, or in some cases kind of gives them a will to kind of keep going. And I sometimes feel that people that find their spark incredibly early in life, they either go on to achieve greatness very, very quickly, or they go to be very, very happy very quickly, but you can end up kind of burning out quite quickly. And we see that, you know, you can kind of see that kind of all the time. Academically, did you then go to like college, further education, university, stuff like that after you left school?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, well, you know, when I was in high school, I did think of myself as a creative kid, and I liked, you know, kind of acting in the plays, like doing that sort of thing, like theater stuff and writing and performing in those sorts of ways. And so I went to college thinking that I would be a theater major. Well, I was a theater major. Oh. And I saw that as like, this is what I can do. And I don't know if I had any grand scheme for where that would take me, other than I would be acting or performing somewhere. And it didn't last that long, because I feel like pretty quickly into the theater program, I realized this was not what I wanted to do, but I still wanted to like make stuff or like be, you know, and that sort of. So I became a creative writing major. And so I would so I did a lot of that. I did a lot of writing. I did a lot of like creative nonfiction. And so I studied that. I ended up getting a degree in English. But then I always thought what I would do with that would be to be a writer, to be a novelist. But what I didn't know at the time is that writing is difficult. Like doing it is hard. And what I didn't know about myself is I don't like doing stuff that is difficult and hard. What I really liked the feeling of having written. I didn't love sitting down to write. And I can't tell you how many times that I would be like, I'm going to write today. I'm going to do it. I'm going to write. And I would sit down and I would like torture myself, like not being able to like make sentences go across the screen like I thought I would. And I don't know. And it was a disappointment for me though. Like, cause I was like, this is what I've dreamed of for a while. Cause I did dream of that for a while.
Yeah.
Wanted to like write something and have something published, and I would set deadlines for myself, like I'm gonna have something published by the time I'm 25 or by the time I'm 30 or whatever other milestone year has come and gone in my life. And and I didn't actually get anything published until I was in my early 40s, and what I got published was a board game. It wasn't a novel at all, you know.
But then I see that, I mean, as somebody who writes, and when you've not, I mean, you have to set yourself kind of deadlines. And I think if I was just writing a blog about kind of things and experiences, I don't think there would be a kind of anything there at all. And one of the reasons that I kind of like producing the blog is because, like, yeah, I wrote a review about that, you know, that old wallpaper, but it follows a process where AEG, Vlad at AEG, who, you know, we deal with there, he's like, I'm going to send you a copy of this game. Now, what I expect you is I expect you to play it. I expect you to look at it. I expect you to kind of give your thoughts and your opinions on it. But then that's setting a kind of a deadline. And it's almost like one of these things. If I don't do it, then I'm letting Vlad down, and I'm letting kind of AEG down, and I'm letting kind of myself down, because it's almost like kind of setting your goal. And sometimes when you're writing something, some things will just flow out of you like nobody's business. Like, see, mm-hmm. I mean, in all honesty, see writing the review for that old wallpaper, it was easy. I think I got the first draft down within about, you know, an hour to an hour and a half.
Oh, for real? Wow.
Because I just talk, because I usually write how I talk. And luckily I've, like, over the piece, I've developed kind of like pretty fast typing.
Yeah.
So what I'll do is as I'm talking, I'll be typing away, and it's almost like it becomes like a stream of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And that's why I always try and start the reviews with like some kind of conscious thought on it, as opposed to just like some kind of introduction. Because you know what it's like if you're faced with a blank page. You know, Tolkien's biggest enemy wasn't a pile of orcs about to attack him. Tolkien's probably biggest enemy was a blank sheet of paper in front of him.
Saying, sure.
Well, how, mm-hmm. you know, how do I even begin to kind of start this? And I think little and often is the kind of the way through. But I'm a big believer in just getting stuff done. It's not like deadlines. What it is, it's getting started, and then once you're started, you can decide where the deadline is going to be for it. You know, so if you're starting a novel, the important thing is not to say, I'm going to get 10 chapters written by November. The important thing is to actually start writing those 10 chapters, and then from there you can then say, well, it takes me X amount of time to write it, and that kind of gives you a time scale. So when I'm doing the reviews, it's important to me. I don't usually write the reviews based off an awful lot of games I bought. I have done, but then I'm a bit more lackadaisical with them. Whereas if I'm dealing with review copies, I know, well, if I leave this for too long, then people are going to say, well, we've had this game for months. What's he been doing with it? And it's like, sometimes I just, you get writer's block, Nathan. You're trying to write there. You're just like, how do I start? Or you write 300 words and you just go, this is crap. And I'm just kind of throwing it away.
I think that a lot of creative people, like whatever it is that they do, you know, write or music or whatever, you know, art, I think that in their minds they think part of the reason why I'm not able to produce as much as I would like is because I don't have deadlines. Like you were saying, like if I had a deadline, I would have a reason to make something. And I think that's a little bit true, but I think what's maybe even more true is, and part of the reason why I enjoyed school so much, why school was so much easier for me than like being an adult, is that I think instead of deadlines, what we need is assignments. The reason most people don't make their thing, they don't write their novel, they don't write their song, they don't make their painting or whatever, is because there's no one making them do it. There's no one asking for it. You know, I talk about this a lot. The reason, like, if anybody wanted a novel from me, there's a better chance that I would do it. But no one is out there be like, when's Nathan Thornton going to write a novel? No one is saying that. Mm. But if I were assigned a novel, it would be different. And I think there's a thing that, there's also the idea of like having content, like you know, in the unpublished games network. There's a guy, Ben, and he always says this thing is like, hey, if I were to tell you make a board game, you have until the end of the week, you'd be like, I don't know what to do. But if he was like, okay, make a board game and it should be about a hot air balloon festival and it should have dice and it can't have any score sheets. Like, then you've got an assignment, then you have something to go off of, something you can start with, you know? Yeah. And I think that is the challenge with creative people, is like the assignment kind of has to come from you, and you have to be the one who is in charge of that. Cause the world is not waiting for your podcast and the world is not waiting for your board game. You know, it's like, you have to come up with the assignment and you have to set the deadline.
I think one of the best things I've done is put restrictions on the size of work as well, and I've learned this through kind of I'm doing regular pieces for Tabletop Gaming Magazine. So I've done a couple of what they call cardboard manifestos, but it is quite literally me as an old man shouting at a cloud. But then you do review pieces as well, but it's a printed magazine. There's no real digital format. So it's like your editor's like, well, you've got to fit this review into either 300 words, 600 words, or 1,200 words. So all of a sudden, you kind of get that restriction on you. So now you just can't go ahead, and I just can't go ahead and kind of waffle for, you know, 1,500 words. Now all of a sudden, I've got to take my thought, and I've got to condense it and crystallize it down into a certain thing. And I think restrictions are a good thing. I was talking about this with an episode that just came out today, by the time of recording, with Skippy Brown, and he was of the view, well, I says, is there any kind of games, if you could create any games at all and kind of time was no object and money was no object and components were no object, he says, well, I can do that anyway. Mm-hmm. But it's being restricted. And I says, well, have you ever thought about maybe creating like a smaller kind of 18 card game?
Okay.
So for something like that, because then you're kind of restricted. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes, as we talk about like having the blank sheet of paper in front of you, or the blank sheet of paper, or the blank canvas, or the guitar just sitting in your lap or whatever. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just like you need somebody to come up and say, okay, I want you to do a watercolor of that bridge, or I want you to write, and you're only allowed 600 words, or I want you to kind of write me a song, but you're only allowed to use these four major chords and this one minor chord. Mm-hmm. And I think when you put restrictions on something, that sometimes kind of gets people to kind of dial in. So how far did you get with kind of the writing? Is it like me that there are kind of I have a Google Docs drive folder that's got various kind of finished, mm-hmm. half-finished drafts of stuff, or do you have a lot of stuff that's been, have you done smaller stuff? Have you had poems published or short writing published, anything along those lines?
I have had some short, like not poetry. It's never been something that I was interested in, mm-hmm. in writing or in reading, but like I have had some short, like humor pieces published, like online and in some like a print literary, like magazines, like that sort of thing. Like it's been a little while since I did anything like that. But not very much fiction. I feel like fiction was what I wanted to write because it's what I wanted. It's what I love to read.
Yeah.
But I was never able to get there. But I do feel like more like when you were talking about your board game reviews, how it becomes more stream of consciousness. I feel like I'm able to do that kind of writing where it feels like I'm in a state of flow where things are just happening and it feels natural when I'm writing something that is more of like, you know, a humor piece or an essay or like an opinion or, you know, yeah. I've written a couple of essays about movies that were meaningful to me. And like, that's where I wrote a bunch of those and I was like, maybe I could turn this into something. And I haven't done so yet, but I think that's where, that's the kind of writing that has felt the most satisfying to me. And more so than fiction. I'm like any of the attempts that I've made at fiction, I feel like I've probably completed 5 or 6 short stories. I've probably started, you know, hundreds, you know?
Yeah. Did you, in terms of then the creation side of things, what kind of pushed mm-hmm. you into board games then? Because as far as, you know, I mean, you've got games published now. Was that something that was also just sitting on the side? Was that something that kind of sideswiped you all of a sudden? It's like, oh, you can develop a board game. I don't want to develop a board game. No, but fate is saying thou shalt develop a board game. I mean, how did you end up kind of falling into that side of the choir, I guess?
Yeah, as an adult, I kind of fell back into board games, like playing games with my friends. I played games with my children once I had them, and I would play them with people at work. We would have, like at lunchtime, I would bring in games and we would play them with people at work. And people were like, oh, you should make a board game. You're a creative person. You should make a board game. And I was always like, I don't ever see myself doing that because like there's math. There's like parts of it that are, I feel like were beyond me. I'm not an analytical thinker. I don't think. And so I didn't see that happening. But so the first game I did was a game called Medium, a party game. And it really like what the inspiration for that, if you could call it that, is that it's this improv game that anybody who's been like in the theater or has done like improv will be familiar with, that they call it mind meld, or they call it, you know, whatever. What were you thinking? And it's literally just an exercise where I say a word and you say a word. Mm. We try to like count down again, 3, 2, 1, and just say the word. So it was something that existed out there in the world and that I would do with my friends. I'm like, hey, and I would just go up to a friend and be like, hey, do you have one? And they would know that I meant, let's play this mind meld game.
Yeah.
And I was playing soccer in the yard with my son. And I was thinking about that. And I was like, well, what if that was the game? Like the hard part of that mental improv exercise is coming up with the words. And I was like, well, what if you were we talked about how restrictions can spur on creativity.
Yeah.
What if you were restricted in the words that you could use? What if you, the words were on cards and that was how you got to the things. And then I continued to think like, well, what if like in the game, you were able to kind of engineer those connections mm-hmm. by seeing the word first and then playing your word. And I'm like, could that be a game? and so that was, and I think that like ever since that, I feel like that's kind of how, once you start making games, you kind of rewire your brain to continually ask yourself, like, is this something? Is this a game? Could this be something? I think the same way that like fiction writers or like stand-up comedians or whomever will do is like, is this raw material that's out in the world? Could this be a game? You know? And so that's what it was with Medium. The thought was that that I would put it together and I would kickstart it with a couple of friends of mine. And we ended up actually by chance running into a publisher at a board game convention, and they were like, we would like to publish Medium. And we said, okay, you can. And they did. But it really was just like taking a thing that I like to do. And I think that any of the games that I have tried to make happen were really just based on what's something that I like to do anyway. Could that be a game? And I think that all four of the games that are published and out there are based on what's a thing I like to do anyway. Could that be a game?
I mean, Medium went on to, it was nominated for a Golden Geek.
It was. Yeah, it sure was. It did not win. Did Wavelength win, maybe? I think Wavelength might have beaten it. Good game, too.
Wavelength. Wavelength. Yeah. But that must have been quite cool to kind of put a game out there and then have...
Oh, amazing.
You know, put a game out there and then have somebody kind of like going, oh, well, actually, we think this is good enough for, you know, we think this is good enough to be part of a list. Because, I mean, that's cool. I mean, not kind of being bitter because, you know, we've never been nominated for a Golden Geek Award now, but we're kind of like marshmallows covered in sardines. We're a very niche product, but that must have been kind of cool, because when you got that, is part one of the reasons why you keep on going with the board game design, is it due to some kind of creative validation then? Did you go kind of like...
Yeah, I think you could call it that. Did you go what? Continue?
Well, I mean, did you like going, well, this is finally, as we're talking about earlier on, when you reach your phases in life, are you then going, well, this is actually maybe something that maybe I can't... This is maybe something I have a knack for, something that I can put some time to, and I'm getting to the final result. I'm getting to the kind of completion.
Without a doubt. And I do think that there's like so many steps in the board game process where the validation is like built in that like it always offers you like the next thing that is going to be a satisfying moment, because you know, you start off with an idea like, could this be a game? Could this be a game? And then you start to like, you know, get your index cards out, make your little prototype. Mm-hmm. And then like that part is fun. But then the first validation is the first time you put together enough for a prototype where it's like, oh, this actually works as a game. This has the minimum requirements to be a thing people can sit down and play. It might not be good, but like, I think that there's an inherent satisfaction in that moment. And then the developing is like, what can we do to make this work better? What can we do to like make this be as fun as it could be, to work as well as it can be? I think getting to that is another, like when you reach to the point where you're like, this game is as good as I can make it. That's very satisfying. Mm. And I think the next validation is when you pitch it to publishers, because, you know, every game that I've ever done, I've pitched it to a number of publishers. Every game that I've done that has been successful has been turned down by a publisher or two. And I think that once you like, here's the idea that I had, here's the name of it, here's how it works. When you say that to someone for the first time and they're like, oh, I get what you're saying, that's interesting enough to me that I'd like to try that myself, you know, to a publisher, whomever, there's something supremely satisfying about that. Because, like, you know, the publishers that you pitch to, they tend to be the one whose games you admire or the games you enjoy. Mm-hmm. And like, to for them to say, I've made this game that you love, Nathan, and I see this game that you're showing me as on par with this game that you love in one way or another, that's hugely satisfying. And then if it gets nominated for an award, or if it gets picked up by some large retailer, like, each one of those is just another thing to like shoot for. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I love that, like, there are all of those moments all along the path that just starts with a blip of an idea that you had when you were playing in the yard with your son.
But I mean, that old wallpaper, I mean, mm-hmm. fair enough, Medium seemed to be like, you know, it's party game material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that old wallpaper was upper, that was getting kind of higher level, because to me that wasn't just two people deciding, can you guess what's on my wallpaper?
Yeah, right.
I mean, there was strategy involved, there was hand drawing involved, there was kind of mm-hmm. like, you were literally calculating potential scoring and stuff like that. So how did you come up? Was that just something you were just mucking around with and just went, you know, or were you hanging about kind of like the old people's home before they kicked you out again? And you're like, I'm gonna do a game about some wallpaper and you can't stop me. But how did the idea for that kind of come about?
Well, you know, I've always hung around old people's homes and they can't stop me because I have a number of fake mustaches, a number of disguises. They'll never catch me. I just love their wisdom. I love to learn. But no, with, you know, you're right though, because Medium is literally one sentence, like, it's this, it's this, that's how you play the game. Yeah. And that old wallpaper, not a very complicated game, but more complicated than Medium.
Yeah.
And actually the only like game that I've done that's been published that is not a party game. And I think that, like we were talking about earlier, like Roald Dahl, like you get known for your children's stories. That's what the world wants from you. And I think that's a little bit happened with, you know, the party games, is that's what publishers expect to hear from you. So I, you know, my hat's off to AEG for taking a chance on that old wallpaper, and the way that that one came together, and the way that I think a lot of games come together is you have like little bits of ideas, like little pieces of the system or like ideas for a theme or whatever. And then as you develop, it's like, well, maybe this little system would work together with this little system. Because where that old wallpaper started, and it wasn't a game about wallpaper at the beginning, was like kind of a card drafting game. And what I liked was this idea that there were a number of piles in the middle of the table of cards, some that would be more attractive than others. And everybody would pick one of the piles that they wanted. Like, say if there were four piles, we would all have tokens that said 1, 2, 3, and 4. Mm. And say if number three had like six cards in it, number two had one card in it, number three is going to be the most attractive one. So the way that it worked at the beginning was you pick which pile you wanted, and you only got it if you're the only person who picked that pile. So then if three is appealing and two is unappealing, do I go for three knowing that it's less likely that I'll get it because it's going to be appealing to everyone? Or do I go for two knowing it's maybe more of a sure thing because it's not as appealing, but at least I'll get something?
Yeah.
Or is everybody going to do that, so I don't go for two and maybe that's my chance to go for three? Like, I loved that idea that, like, if we flip over our tokens and everybody said one and I said three, I get three. That's cool. I love that all or nothing kind of idea. And you've played it, and you know that there is some of that DNA still in the game.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
But not exactly that. It's more forgiving than it was when it started. But I like that idea, and so I had a couple of versions of that. Like, it was originally going to be, what was it originally called? It was originally going to be called. Sexy Pizza Genius. I forget why. That was just what I called it in the beginning. And then it was going to be called America. Because Sexy Pizza Genius was like, there were sexy cards, there were pizza cards, and there were genius cards. And you had to put together like different combinations. Okay, it didn't really work as a theme. But then it was going to be called American Legends, and it was going to be based on like tall tales and folklore from America.
Yeah.
So like Paul Bunyan. John Henry, like Annie Oakley, like those sorts of people. But that seemed a little, and so what you were going to do is like collect like sets of the person and then like their equipment and then their story, like you were telling tall tales, like that's where it was. And I kind of got a little bit far with that version of it, but then I was thinking about like, I don't know, but that theme, aside from Sexy Pizza Genius, I wanted it like to do something that was unique. And so, but I thought about, when I was a kid, I would spend the night at my grandma's house, and I would sleep in my like uncle's old bedroom, and I would have a hard time falling asleep because I was a kid and I was in an unusual place and I was scared, you know? And so I would lay awake and I would look at the wallpaper and I would trace it with my eyes. And I've talked about this with other people. I'm like, did you have this experience of being a kid and sleeping in an unfamiliar place and like having a hard time sleeping? And so you just like watched the ceiling and traced like the patterns in the ceiling or on the wall. And I talked to enough people that I feel like that was a universal enough experience that I'm like, well, what if the game was about reconstructing that pattern in the wallpaper that you saw as a kid? And then I looked on Board Game Geek to see if there were any games about wallpaper, and I couldn't find any. And so I was like, well, that's it. That's what the name of the game should be. The name of the game should be Remember That Old Wallpaper We Used to Have. And so I started to put that into a logo, and people said that name is too long, and it was too long. And so by the time I pitched it to AEG, it was changed from Remember That Old Wallpaper We Used to Have to just
That Old Wallpaper. Mm-hmm. Did you have any decisions over the design of the cards? Because I looked at the design of the cards, and I was instantly, this is like being in my grandma's house. But who am I kidding? I'm a child of the 80s, so this was like being in my old house in the 70s. I'm pretty sure my Facebook profile picture, there is several recognizable bits of wallpaper. It's an amazing picture. It's me in a romper suit, because I must have been about a year old, holding a packet of cigarettes. Because in those days, kids could smoke. I mean, it's like what you got.
We didn't know.
You used to get chocolate. You'll remember this. You used to get packs of candy.
Mm-hmm.
And they had like Spider-Man or whatever on the front cover, or, you know, mm-hmm. I used to open them up and used to have little sticks of candy, white sticks of candy. Right. And they used to have mm-hmm. little red ends, and it used to emulate cigarettes.
Right. And there was, I feel like there was a kind that where there was a little bit of like powder, whether it was sugar or something on the outside, where if you could blow on it, it would look a little bit like smoke was coming out of the end of the candy cigarette. Oh, yeah.
And you also used to get kind of like chocolate, little chocolate tubes, and they used to be covered in rice paper, and they looked like...
I don't know if I remember that.
They looked like cigars. And you used to it used to be the case that was so many people used to smoke. So anyway, I am aware of the kind of the wallpaper, but my question was, how much influence did you have over the design of the different wallpaper?
That old wallpaper, I worked with my friend Danielle Deli, who's on there as well, and she is an artist, and she did the art for the original prototype. Uh-huh. Of the game, the one that we pitched to AEG. Mm-hmm. And so when we started working with them, it was Matt Paquette who did the actual graphic design and the art for the final product. And so AEG was great. We worked really closely with them all throughout. Mm-hmm. And so what I did, I've always loved like that era of like 60s and 70s like design and stuff. And so we just pulled a bunch of images of like living rooms from those eras and pictures of furniture stores and wallpaper and send them. And it's funny because I feel like that there were two extremes. There was one that where it started to look a little too like a game show. Like, I don't know if you know, like The Price is Right. As a game show,
I like the kitschiness of it. I like the kind of the font totally. was the font it was just striking and amazing. And I can imagine kind of game show. It did look like you would get, you know, it would go, and it's time for that old wallpaper, you know.
Right.
Chester Cheevely, you know, and it'd be like that. But that, I mean, that's not everything from the kind of like the logo to the card art and everything like that.
Yeah.
And it didn't look like it was taking itself too seriously. There's so many, many games, right? And, you know, I've got a bunch, just, you know, I'm surrounded by them. I can't get away from them, Nathan. They're everywhere. But many games that have so much kind of serious kind of art, even the ones that are like meant to be kind of like big and fun and cartoony, they're still kind of fairly kind of serious. And here was something that I was putting on the table that looked kind of garish and unfashionable and
ugly, a little bit
disgraceful, and all different types of things that you wouldn't want to see. You know, if you were on the dating scene and you'd gone to the local club and there was somebody at the club that you liked and you were playing that old wallpaper, you'd probably hide it from them because they'd be going like that. Oh, that looks a bit old fashioned. But then you get them to play it and they'd realize how much fun it is. But so
I would say it's aggressively uncool. You know, it's it is not intended to. I mean, it's a game about wallpaper, which is in and of itself a preposterous thing. And so, like, the idea is that it's not – well, because, I mean, at its heart, it is an abstract game.
Yeah, it's lovely.
So why not lean into the silliness of it being wallpaper? And some of, like, the criticism I've seen a bit online is that it is garish and that it is ugly. And, like, and it's hard not to think, like, that's the point, you know? I mean, I've got so many game boxes that are just beige, right. You know what I mean? I feel like we all have so many games that are just so boring looking that you don't care because, like, you enjoy, you know, building castles in Burgundy or whatever it might be. But yeah, it looks the way it does too, for that reason, to be like, let's celebrate the ridiculousness of playing a game that is about remembering what wallpaper
is. Exactly. But talking about remembering everything ever.
Oh, okay. Oh, you're going there. Good. Let's talk about
Let's talk about this because this seems to be you going back into the kind of the party game.
Mm-hmm.
You've been out in the kitchen talking to your friends, glass of white wine. Now you're going back into the living room again, and everybody's kind of like,
you're painting a picture.
You brought everything ever with you. So, do you want to tell us a little bit about kind of that? Because that seems to be back into the party game kind of room.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah, no, and so everything ever is, it is a party game. It is one of the lightest party games that there are. And I feel like the criticism will be that it's more of an activity than a game. And I am fine with that because I do think that activities are a fun thing you can do with the people that you care about. And I think everything ever is one of those, I guess. It kind of comes from, you know, the idea for it, it's one of the things that I love to do with my friends or with my kids or with my family or whomever, when we're on a car ride or we're in line for something, is just like, hey, let's name Tom Cruise movies. Let's go around. We'll all name Tom Cruise movies, or let's go around and we'll name songs that have the word baby in them or whatever it might be. Mm. And I think it's the kind of mental activity that lets you kind of show off what you know while at the same time not having to know that much, you know, because I mean anybody can name, you know, a movie with a dog in it or two or three or four. And so I think that's so much fun. I love that idea of just like, let's go around and list things. But I thought where everything ever got a little silly, I love the name because you know, purportedly you're listing everything ever. So, cause there's stuff about songs, about movies, the world, about people, about, you know, books, whatever it might be. And I think the silliness of having to name two different things at the same time, like naming a princess and, you know, naming a, you know, a movie or a TV show that has the name of a city in it. Like having your brain operate on those two tracks at the same time, I think is something that I find so enjoyable to do. And then it gives you the added layer of, another thing you can do in Everything Ever is if you can name one thing that fits in both categories. Like I was playing it at Gen Con, and the two cards were, one card was every character's catchphrase, and the other one was everything that can fly. So people were saying, you know, birds, and people were saying, you know, cowabunga man or whatever the catchphrase is. And then someone said, Shazam for a character's catchphrase and someone that can fly. I think those little moments make it so cool when people can make that connection. I'd love those. I would never in my 100 years have thought of Shazam as being a catchphrase and something that can fly, but it was perfect.
But I mean, you're right in saying activity games, but some of the most kind of fun games that I've played, they're all based around a single sentence or two kind of premise.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the ones that you know you can get into and they're accessible. One of the, and I'm going to name drop them, Bez, she develops games which are just, you know, it's just quite simple. It's like, pick seven cards and find synergies between these seven cards.
And that's the name of the game
that
too.
That is the name of the game as well. And the game basically has kind of like, it's got a picture of an, it's got a picture of an alien, mm-hmm. and then it's got a picture of a vacuum cleaner. And then you've got another picture of an alien looking slightly different. And then it's got, it's basically saying, and here's a dustpan and brush or something. It goes, or likes, you know, likes keeping the house clean. And your idea is you've got to kind of like find the synergies between the different cards. So you just grab them and then you've got to find the synergies. And if you've got them, but the other one is to develop Yogi as well. Now, Yogi is quite simple. Right. You've just got to follow the instructions on the cards. And that's all you do. And then, so it's like, you know, you've got to pick a card and it's like, well, you've got to put it, you know, you take a card, you've got to balance it on your head, or you take a card, you've got to put it under your armpit. You take a card, you've got to balance it on your knee. And it's become an activity, but I've, you know, these type of things, they lead to kind of like very, very quick, kind of very, very kind of sudden things. And I know, it's very, very easy to kind of get into, not gatekeeping land, but kind of snobbish land, where it's like, that's not the type of game that you kind of look at. But I published... And it's live now, so I can talk about it. But I reviewed kind of Trial by Trolley and Travel by Trolley, which are your Cyanide and Happiness. And I kind of went, it's not my bag. But my son, my youngest, he loved it because it was literally ridiculous things happening very, very quickly. And I was like, well, does it do anything mechanically? If I'm looking at it from a review point of view, does it do anything mechanically wrong or broken or anything like that? And I was like, no, it does exactly what it's meant to be doing, and it does it kind of very, very well. Is there stuff, would I want to particularly play it again and again and again? Well, maybe not, but depending on the situation. If I was at a party atmosphere and we had just played Everything Ever and we were about to play Medium, and then afterwards we're playing like Trial by Trolley, then they all kind of fit in that same genre, and it's all going to be people who are going to be kind of gamers and then casual gamers and people who have never played a game for the first time. And we're kind of introducing kind of more people into the kind of thing. How easy was it to get involved with Floodgate Games? They seem to sit around. I keep hearing them and seeing them different kind of publishing kind of different games. They don't seem to go for a specific set. They seem to have an eclectic kind of mixture of games. So how did the relationship really develop with that?
Well, honestly, it's just, I just reach out to publishers whose games that I liked. I mean, so they published one of my wife's and my favorite games of all time, which is Sagrada.
Yes.
And I'm like, and I, you know, and I try not to limit myself. Like if you read online, like I'm a board game designer, what should I do? And everybody will tell you, you know, look for a publisher who publishes the kind of games that you have.
Yeah.
And I think that is decent advice, but when Medium was published by Greater Than Games, they did not make any party games. They made Sentinels of the Multiverse and they made Spirit Island. Those are not party games.
No.
You know?
No. If you turned up to a party with Spirit Island, you'd be,
that ain't a party
you'd be,
anymore.
You'd be going home by yourself.
Yeah, that's right.
Not it's anybody true. Speaking to you.
For sure. And and the same with Floodgate. It's like, I admired the games that they did, and they do a lot of different kinds of games. Yeah. I don't know, do you know the game Kites that they did last year with the sand timers?
Yes.
Very novel, very innovative. And so I had pitched this and another game to them, and they were like, we've been wanting to do another party game. They had done one a year or two earlier, and they were like, I feel like we learned some lessons in that one, and we're ready to get back into it. And they've been great. They've been really supportive, and so much so that, like, they've been so good to work with in terms of, like, getting the cards right and doing that sort of work with them. But also the art that is on the cards, my friend Danielle Deli, who did the prototype art for That Old Wallpaper, also did the prototype art for Everything Ever. Wow. And Ben Harkins at Floodgate was like, I really like the art that's on this prototype. Could we get Danielle to do the art for the game? And so they hired her. And so she actually did the art for the box and every single card as well. So it ended up looking exactly as I had hoped that it would. So, so they were fantastic. They also... Another thing that I like about them is that they, between Sagrada and Holly and some of their other games, they make really colorful games. And they're games that are really hard to ignore when you see them on a shelf or when you see them on a table. And so I do feel like that there's something really eye-popping about the yellow of the Everything Ever box and all the cards. So they've been really fantastic to work with in terms of having good ideas to improve the game and then listening to, like, your ideas or my ideas to improve it too. So they've been fantastic. I would love to do another game with them.
They've Sagrada was kind of like, Sagrada's become like one of their evergreens. I think it's allowed them to kind of look further afield and look at games that maybe wouldn't necessarily get the kind of exposure, if you know what I mean. So,
yeah, I think that's fair.
You know, so something like Sagrada allows them, when you've got like an evergreen game that's kind of bringing in kind of money all the time. It's like Roxley Games. Yeah. Roxley Games, they did Santorini. Now, Roxley did a whole thing like Steampunk Rally and, so they've got games like that that you'd be... And then Santorini came from nowhere and all of a sudden it's just doing figures and money and everything like that.
Amazing.
It's kind of every, I think it's actually distributed into places like Target and stuff like that. I mean, they've got... Mm-hmm. And it sounds to me like Floodgate with Sagrada, I think they're kind of... I'm pretty sure that if you went down to a Target, you would see the kind of the base game of Sagrada in there as well. Mm-hmm. I guess if they've got this kind of this backup of this kind of this evergreen kind of game continually bringing in money, it allows them to kind of say, normally we wouldn't take a risk on something, but it allows them to go, well, let's try this one. So in terms of for Everything Ever, what's the kind of the distribution side of things with it? Is it going to be a Kickstarter thing? Is it just going straight out to kind of like general release? What's the kind of what you're going to be doing in respect to that?
Yeah, so it's just kind of launching now. Like, it was sold for the first time at Gen Con.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that it's going to go, it's not going to be Kickstarter. It's going to go straight to retail. And my understanding is that it's going to be exclusive with Barnes & Noble
for a little bit. Yeah.
So it'll be there for a while before it's available in other places.
That's not a bad thing.
No, I mean, not at all. Barnes & Noble's doing some good stuff with games.
Well, I mean, you could technically get a book jacket.
Okay.
And you could wrap it around Everything Ever. And you could tell people, look, I've got a book in Barnes and because they do books.
Oh, so check me out.
Your dream was probably...
Yeah, go to one the day I was when, published. Go check me out at the
one
bookstore.
Day is like, one day I was going to be published and people are going to be buying my books in Barnes & Noble.
You're lined up at Barnes & Noble, yeah.
Technically.
Yeah, check the box.
If you get into Target, then, I mean, unless you're on the bestseller list... you know, your book would never end up in places like that anyway. So I think this is
for sure.
I think this is definite kind of win. Do you know, have an idea on kind of prices and stuff like that, what it's going to be retailing for roughly?
Oh yeah, it's going to be $20.
$20.
Yeah. All my games are $20. Oh, yeah.
Lovely. Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. And if people have listened along to today, I keep saying tonight, and that's because I record at night. People think I'm...
Right, but you realize that people can listen to it whenever they like.
I know, I keep forgetting. It's like the magic of podcasting.
Do you know what time of day people typically listen? Do you think it's more of a... Our podcast more of a morning thing than an evening?
I think I am like a hot shot of coffee that people kind of, you know, they get riled up in the morning and they put me on like some kind of Olivia Newton-John workout. And just I'm just there to get their day. So there you go. I'm going to be, you know, so this is where I do the positive affirmation. I say, you're going to go into work today or start your job and you're going to smash it. You're going to do so well. I have no idea. I have checked and it just gives me roughly kind of like days, but it doesn't tell me kind of times when people, I'm sure there's probably metrics you can kind of get, which you can tell you. And it'll probably tell me you're not got enough metrics for us to tell you the time. You should be happy you're getting, you're getting downloads.
No, people love your work.
But if people have loved your work and they want to keep an eye on where you are on the internet webs, where do you exist on the internet webs?
I know. Sadly, like the main place is Twitter, but I feel like Twitter is becoming so much more gross, but that's the main place I've always posted. But it's Storm Chaser Games on Twitter. It's Storm Chaser Games on Instagram. And I have a website that I have not updated in a very long time, which is stormchasergames.com.
we'll make sure that's the first link.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess if people see what the old artwork looked like for all those games, I probably haven't updated it since I pitched anything.
We'll make sure that we put all the links in the show notes so that we've got notes to show. And if you want to keep an eye on where we are up to, then go to the internet and search for We Are Not Wizards and you'll find us in all the unusual places where they keep the shiny wallpaper going. And you can find us on X and what they called Edge and Splurge and Splick and Splock and Fustiness and all these other different places that if you've got kind of like social networks, it's kind of everywhere now. If you like what you've listened to tonight, there's a couple of ways that you can support the show. You can go to your podcast catcher of choice and just drop us a rating or review. If you are going to be giving us a rating or review, then don't give us 10 stars because it makes me big headed and that is, I've got enough head as it is. But don't give us 1 star because it makes us cry. Give us something in the middle, like a 5, because we're average. And it's just a little bit average. The person who's not being average is rather wonderful, rather fantastic. They're everything ever. It's Nathan Thornton. Thank you very, very much for guesting.
And thanks so much for inviting me, Richard. I had an absolute joy talking to you this morning / afternoon / evening.
/ evening. The final test is to remember that we're many things, but we're not wizards. Are we wizards, Nathan?
Not at all.
Wonderful. And the last thing is to say goodbye. So it's a goodbye from Nathan. Say goodbye, Nathan.
So long, everyone, including you, Richard.
And it's a goodbye from me. Remember, stay safe, roll sixes, and make something awful or name something awful. Until the next time, goodbye.
A wizard is never licked. Nor is he early. He arrives precisely when he means to.